I'm Alexander Heffner, your host on The Open Mind. This is an audio podcast exclusive edition of the program. I'm delighted to welcome today Rachel Bitkoffer. She is Senior Fellow at the Niskanen Center and an advisor to the Lincoln Project. Welcome, Rachel.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Rachel, you have written really persuasively about Vice President Biden's VP selection process. How do you think that the escalating protest movement factors into this selection now? You were always advocating the importance of a woman, a person of color on the ticket, and those being the crucial ingredients. So I would imagine your emphasis on that point is even greater now.
It is. I mean, my op-ed in the New York Times articulating the importance to, the center of the electorate is usually very important. In this particular election cycle, though, when we're looking at Donald Trump, the center of the electorate and the it really was secured with the nomination of Joe Biden over somebody like Bernie Sanders, right? So if we were talking about Bernie Sanders being the nominee, then, shoring up that centrist vote would be very important. But with the selection of Biden as the Democratic Party's nominee, that center part of the electorate, given the deep, deep unpopularity that Donald Trump has with that group of voters, both amongst moderates, independents who aren't right-leaning, it's not an area that they just need to hammer and hammer and hammer. And in fact, because of the environment that we're in now, in heightened polarization, and we've got these big factions within the parties, this is really the Achilles heel that got the Democrats in 2016, was mistaking the idea, especially on the Democratic side, that younger voters, voters under the age of 40, more ideological voters, people who would call Bernie supporters, but not necessarily the ones that you see on Twitter who are strident, but there are a lot of people who are ideologically motivated and support the Sanders agenda, who just were not motivated to vote for Hillary Clinton in 2016. And so they didn't show up to vote at all, or they showed up and voted in Wisconsin and places like that, critical places like that, for Green Party candidates, or wrote in Bernie Sanders' names. And those were votes that Hillary Clinton really needed, right? So so my research is really focused on those other aspects of the election math of the polarized era, trying to get Democrats to understand that Republicans have been solving that equation differently for a long time. You never hear a Republican campaign talking about getting Democrats to vote for it. And yet Democrats spend a lot of time anguishing about how to get Republicans to vote for them. Now you might think, well, that must be because there's more Republicans than there are Democrats, but that's not the case either. So it really is kind of a strange strategy. But yes, Biden is got that centrist vote sewn up. And so I'm arguing that what Democrats want to do is avoid a repeat of 2016. They want to make sure that they get strong turnout from the under 40 voters, that millennial and Gen Z voting block, and that they should give the party, this is before the last 10 days, diversity. And obviously, that column published as the George Floyd murder was starting to get headlines. And I think it would be just almost political malpractice for the Biden team not to be looking at this last week and coming up with a conclusion that Black voters need a voice right now at the highest levels of political representation, and they don't have one right now on the ticket. So
right. Rachel, do you think that, given your concerns about third party votes depressing turnout for Biden, your concern about complacency within that demographic, is it at all tempered by the thousands of people protesting in the streets that has the potential to be electorally catalyzed in the fall?
It does, yeah. I mean, it's exactly the kind of emotion that my modeling would like to see, right? So, to see the cities and streets all across the country exploding months before the election with anger, even though it's not directly related to Democratic politics, this is an issue that's tangentially related. It is definitely a good sign for the negative partisanship model, but there's also danger in it, right? So the party's base, the most strident element of it, is advocating for things that, even though I tell some, I'm arguing you don't need to cater to the center of the electorate, and even when you do, there's a way to talk to it that's more effective than the way that Democrats do now. That doesn't mean that you go, I equated it to ripping all your clothes off, jumping into the pond naked, and covering your body with glitter, right? And, to some extent, this defund the police message is kind of doing that, right? It's putting Biden in this awkward position where when the activists say defund the police, what they mean is take up city's police department and reorganize it, right? And they don't want to use the word reform because somehow reform denotes too modest a revamp, right? So they've decided to go with this defund the police posture. But in politics, when you're explaining things, it's difficult, right? Nuance is very difficult. And so, it puts Biden in a position. And today, of course, he was forced to take a position. Are you going to support defunding the police? And, in Biden's advisory world, it's a very buttoned up, conservative leaning. And I don't mean conservative like Republican, but conservative in terms of strategy. Leaning group of people that he surrounds himself with. Of course, he's going to be cautious. And so he said no, right? And so there is this potential now that there's a group of these activists, and this will overlap heavily with the progressives, that will look at Biden now and say, see, he is just like Trump, right? And of course he's not. And he's extremely liberal on race issues and does robustly support a reform agenda for criminal justice. And, his election is a gulf of difference on that issue. So it's a mixed bag, I would say.
A mixed bag. And is it persuasive, do you think, to the center and to the left as well to say defund police violence, abolish police brutality? Is it not marketable to a broad swath of constituencies to reject the idea that you're eliminating police forces, but say very straightforwardly, where you're not going to fund the malfeasance, the corruption, the plague on communities that we've been seeing? And isn't that very visible to the American people, because we had a president who threatened to unleash a military invasion, a presence that had never been seen against its own citizens. So I wonder if the fallout from the defunding the police is not going to be as significant as the Republicans would like it in this.
Oh, no, it definitely won't be, because, yeah, in a different electoral environment, though, it could hurt them much more than it will now. But like I said, that center of the electorate is going to be asked to choose between Biden and Trump. And Trump is a hot mess. I mean, the man has imposed himself in the White House around a big, giant black, wired with, what's that stuff that at the top with the barbed wire gates and fence around the White House, and a, nameless, faceless, rankless military force. So, there's a lot, in other words, there's a lot of wiggle room this year, the cycle, for moderate and independent voters, and not all independents, of course, are moderates. So some independents are extremely radical, and they will be galvanized by a defund the police, slogan. Now, of course, you could get the same value, because it's not, the policy is, as you pointed out, the way that you explained it, is a perfectly rational policy. it's the slogan that is going to probably cause some electoral trouble for Biden in terms of how he handles it, especially because he's not particularly swift, right, in terms of navigating these kinds of issues. And even Kamala Harris won her first go of it in the media, didn't handle it very well.
Rachel, your specialty electorally has been looking at the influence of the press turnout in coalitions, namely how third parties can eat away at your nominee's support. That was the case in 2016. You wrote in the New Republic about 2018 and 2018 as a referendum on Donald Trump and the galvanizing of anti-Trump energies to take back the House. Looking at the current climate, the Democrats never really gave credit to Ralph Nader or Gary Johnson or Jill Stein where credit was due in precluding their nominees from winning the Electoral College. How much of that depends on Biden's VP, and how much does that depend on how effective those third parties can be in their attempt to mobilize and bring voters into them?
Great deal of it is atmospheric. So, you know, in 2016, I think there was an assumption that the Democratic majority had arrived, that it was safely locked in, that one could go to Wisconsin and write in Bernie Sanders' name and it wouldn't matter because Hillary Clinton was going to win Wisconsin anyway. So I think, like, atmospherically, you know, that's the big difference maker. And really that's, you know, primarily what my research is really trying to get people to understand is how big these aggregated atmospheric fundamentals, you know, matter and where they're now constrained to by polarization, like the economy, right? Things like that. So, you know, to some degree, I think the third party voting risk is much less than it was in 2016, because a lot of people who felt free to do it in 2016 will not feel that way in 2020. That said, you know, it's not just Democrats that have lost elections due to third party candidates. The Republicans have given up many elections too, to libertarian spoilers. So it's a pretty common threat. But in the case of 2020, I think what's really different is that when you're looking at how to reelect Donald Trump 2 years ago, and you're tasked with that job, and you have a man who can't crack 45% approval, and you know, in a head-to-head has never cracked 47%, you're tasked with reelecting him, and you understand the first election hinged really heavily on pulling down the two-party vote share to a plurality where a plurality would be good enough to win, then you understand the need to recreate those conditions. So the Republican Party is going to put a ton of money and infrastructure on targeting Bernie Sanders voters, disaffected progressive voters, and people of color, you know, to suppress their vote or to get them to not vote for Joe Biden, as a goal of, you know, lowering that two-party vote share down enough where Trump can once again kind of squeeze through the hole. And, you know, they're going to spend a lot of money on it. So I think it would be foolish to ignore it or to not take that threat seriously. Now, people are generally poo-poo the idea that a vice presidential pick would be important in mitigating this. But when you look at what the Republicans did with Mike Pence, you know, evangelicals were not cold to Trump by any means. He was very competitive in Iowa. Ted Cruz, what killed him in Iowa was the fact that Trump was doing decent amongst Iowa evangelicals, despite his checkered history and questionable personal morals. But what really got the evangelical party and the base behind him for Trump was that selection of Mike Pence, which was, you know, a signal to the Republican Party that this, you know, business guy, shifty guy from New York, you know, was going to do things for conservatives. And right. So I
think, amen, Rachel. You know, I've said many times, citing your work, if Chris Christie had been the VP, there's no sense I have that Trump would have prevailed in you know, pulling out the red in the reddest counties. But back to the question of third party, you know, Nader and Perot had name ID. And so for that secondary factor, if the VP is sort of the most important proactive step the Biden folks can take, how much does it matter whether the Green nominee or the Libertarian nominee have name ID or have had run statewide in the past? You know, if they're essentially nobodies, will that be in Biden's favor?
Well, let me make something crystal clear. For some reason, people still hold up Ralph Nader as the quintessential spoiler. He is not. Nader's spoiling effects were inconsequential compared to the data from 2016 in Wisconsin, which is pretty emblematic of all the swing states in 2016, a state that Trump carried over Clinton by less than 1%, more than 6% of the electorate cast protest ballots, okay? That is 2 to 3 times higher than what you would have seen in the Florida so-called spoiler election with Nader. So we're talking about like an election that was defined by this protest balloting in 2016.
Right.
And yet no one talks about it. And right. It's much more important, that defection role, than the predictable and long-term realignment of white working class voters away from the Democratic Party, which had been happening for a long time. And, you know, it's amazing to me that people are looking at Nader still, when in Florida, I mean, he barely cracked, I don't even know if he cracked 2% of the vote in Florida. And we're talking about, you know, a third party spoiler rate that climbs into the 4, 5, 6% range in these swing states in 2016. So.
Sure. Well, but to the question about name ID, Gary Johnson and Bill Weld and Jill Stein even having run statewide in Mass, it's not clear whether or not that enabled them to connect with voters or have some infrastructure, even though the disinformation networks did aid them.
Yeah.
Does that matter? And is there some reassurance the voting public can have and that you would have if these nominees are not significant political figures, or does that not matter?
Yeah, no, certainly. Let's say that 2020 had a celebrity libertarian. I mean, that would be a huge factor, right? You know, or repeats from 2016, which it does not. Gary Johnson or Jill Stein, those would be major factors as well. So yeah, lacking, you know, name ID and name recognition and infrastructure are all important. I think the main factor though in 2016 was this sense, because you got to keep in mind, Johnson picked up libertarian votes come predominantly from Republican type voters, conservatives, but not all the way, and certainly not in 2016. There was a ton of pot voters, people who, you know, oh, the guy smokes pot, hell, I'm voting for. And he was unabashedly, you know, a pot smoker. It was, you know, for many people, I hate Clinton, I hate Trump. It doesn't really matter what I do anyway. The election's going to be won by Clinton. All the forecasts and polls say so. I'm going to vote for this guy that smokes pot, you know? So
with Justin Amash bidding out, it appears for the moment that this cycle there will not be any significant name ID represented in a Reform Party or Green Party or Libertarian ticket, right?
Yeah, right now, I mean, I don't know what's going on with the Jesse Ventura run. So I don't know, but, you know, and also he's a bygone. He's kind of like a, you know, but celebrity is always dangerous because we're a country that loves celebrity, even if it is, you know, B-list, C-list, D-list celebrity types like Donald Trump.
So let me ask you this to close on. When we talk about how Trump, with the Pence pact, if you will, you know, governed by Pence, far right orthodoxy, that the Trump-Pence ticket was able to turn out more in the deeply red than the McCain-Palin or the Romney-Ryan tickets were able to galvanize the deep red vote. And what I wanted to understand from you is those folks who came into the Trump coalition, who voted at, you know, record levels in those red counties, what was primarily motivating them? Was it culture or was it economics?
Oh, God, no, it was definitely culture. And not culture either. I mean, it's you know, white identity politics, which is a new line of research that a political scientist, Ashley Jardina, has a great book about and by the same title. And it really correlates nicely or dovetails nicely with some other research by another female political scientist named Liliana Mason that's called Uncivil Agreement. It looks at how in the modern polarized era, party ID has become a social identity, the way that, you know, being a member of a church or a civic league used to be a social identity. Now being a Republican or a Democrat is a social identity. And so those two things are, you know, what Trump was tapping into, this Wisconsin rural resentment type of fervor. And, you know, people like to point out, oh, you know, look, Trump underperformed Romney, but they usually don't mention, but actually he overperformed Romney in a lot of other areas, right? Because again, what that is measuring really is this long-term coalitional realignment of college-educated white voters moving to the Democrats and non-college-educated whites moving to the Republicans.
And just to be clear, when I asked you though about the economic, I really mean economic in terms of pocketbook. And I think your answer, Rachel, may be the same. But as we see the temporary effect of the market from the pandemic, and now the market higher than it was pre-pandemic, I think at the time we're recording this, I do wonder, even in, you know, what you're describing, the reddest of red, how much that will enable those counties, those municipalities, to double down on their own economic argument, because the studies also seem to show from 2016 and historically that wealthier folks vote for the Republicans, and wealthier folks tend to vote more than poorer, low-income folks. So I just wonder how that dynamic is working in your...
That's changing, right? Because college education and income are highly correlated. So as college-educated voters are becoming more Democratic, income is also changing. So keep that in mind. And, you know, here's the thing. In controlled studies, which model all these different factors for vote choice in 2016 to test the power of the populist message or the economic message against the racist attitudes or, you know, sexism and things like that. Even when you control for everything, those sexist and racist attitudes were the big predictors of Trump support. So we know for sure in quality, peer-reviewed academic research how powerful those motivators were. And here's what my prediction is. You know, we have had an economic collapse. So that economic collapse is going to be a major feature of the fall cycle in these rural areas. The economic strife there is going to be profound. We're probably looking, you know, at a double-digit unemployment rate still in September, October. And yet you're going to still see Trump as the incumbent president, support remain completely rock steady there. And ultimately, when the data happens, when the election happens, that turnout threshold is probably be very similar to what we saw in 2016. It may even increase. And so that's kind of interesting, right? Because you'd think, well, if it's economics, wouldn't there be some kind of penalty for the incumbent amongst these voters for delivering a poor economic performance? Because these voters are going to be literally, you know, in breadlines, a lot of them. And we're talking about rural America paying, you know, a pretty, you know, and it's going to be pretty painful in a lot of these rural communities. So I think that's really going to show the disconnect now in the hyper-polarized world that we're living in between the old factors that used to move voting behavior, which was economic factors, and now what moves voter behavior, which is these partisan identities, which are shaped by these cultural, racial, gender attitudes. And I think, you know, we can see that right now in the inelasticity of Trump's approval data, which has, it's the only country of all the democracies on earth that were all measured through the pandemic. The pandemic comes in and you can see the public opinion of the president or world leader go up or go down. It reacts. There's only one country in which it remains stagnant, and that's America, right? And that is a symptom of a very sick body politic, that something as massive of a political stimulus as this pandemic and this economic collapse can't, the public can't react to it. It's locked in into these two tribal like halves. And so I think we're really gonna see the folly of the economy as a predictor in the fall.
Rachel, making sense as always. I just can't, I'm discombobulated and can't get my head around the stock market. The stock market's recovery, and I think it just shows the disconnect between stock market speculation and real people's lives. And
oh gosh, yes.
100,000.
We always have a disconnect between like Main Street and Wall Street. Yeah. Never like we're gonna see this fall.
But I never thought that with over 100,000 dead, that the market would have recovered, and not just the 100,000 dead, but the unemployment statistics. Yes. I mean, that's hard to fathom until you recognize the point that Sanders folks have made and that the new Democratic Party has made in that this capitalistic system doesn't reflect the values or the livelihoods of most folks. So it's just statistically such an, the most incongruous thing I've ever heard, given the economic and mortal blow of this virus, that the market would have rebounded as it has by now.
Yeah, it's disconcerting to say the least, right?
It is.
And because of it too, I'll tell you, but it guarantees, like it basically guarantees, because Republicans control the Senate and the White House, prolonged and profound pain for Main Street.
Right. Well, on that note,
I'm always a great dinner date.
No, you're making sense always. And folks who are listening, please follow Rachel Bitcoffer on Twitter. Thanks for joining me today.
Well, thanks for having me.